Before we get into today's episode, I want to let you know about a source of powerful free resources to help you as a parent or grandparent get equipped to invest in the faith of the next generation. Our Next Gen website has been designed to help empower you to navigate tough issues with the young people in your life. At Next Gen, you'll find articles, entertainment reviews from a Christian perspective, parenting stories, helpful parenting guides, and even answers to the tough questions. All these resources are free as you engage on the front line of raising the next generation for Jesus. So why not register today at premierinsight.org/resources to receive free resources from NextGen. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Well, welcome along this Saturday afternoon. Thank you for joining me, Justin Brierley, for the programme that gets Christians and non-Christians talking every Saturday here on Premier Christian Radio. Also broadcasting as a popular podcast at premier.org.uk/unbelievable. If you haven't listened to that, or if you like explored our vast archive of past programmes, do encourage you to do that. premier.org.uk/unbelievable. And a whole host of other resources there at the newly revamped website. It's a great programme I've got coming up for you today as we ask the question, why won't God go away?
You're unbelievable.
Of course, the last few years have been marked by something called the New Atheism. It's been a rash of books have been published by people like Richard Dawkins, Christopher Hitchens, Sam Harris, Daniel Dennett. But where is the movement now, some 5 years on, since The God Delusion here in the UK was published? Alistair McGrath is Professor of Theology, Ministry and Education at King's College London. His new book is called Why God Won't Go Away, and it's published by SBCK. He's going to be telling us about it and the ways in which he is responding to the New Atheism. Well, in conversation with Alistair today is Stephen Law. He's an atheist. He's provost of the Centre for Inquiry UK. And we're going to be hearing about his thoughts on the whole area of the New Atheism and some of the key themes that come up in Alistair's book and special news on how you could attend the UK launch of the book. All to come here on the programme. Well, welcome along, gentlemen. It's great to have you both on. Not so long since you were both actually on the programme before. I think back in September-ish, Alistair, we had you on talking about Hawking and his claims that God has been made redundant as a cause of the universe. And also, actually, in conversation, this was before the book sort of had been finalised, but on the New Atheism with Caspar Melville of New Humanist magazine. Great to have you back. Thanks for joining us again. And Stephen, you were on not so long ago yourself in conversation with Alvin Plantinga.
Yes, it was fun.
It was good fun, wasn't it? And I hope we can do something again in that sort of realm. But today we're talking about the New Atheism, which is a term coined really to, if you like, describe a particular brand, let's say, of atheism, perhaps a more militant, more aggressive form of atheism that emerged with, obviously, the publications of people like Richard Dawkins and Christopher Hitchens. Alistair, you've been a key respondent to the New Atheism. Tell us, though, 5 years on, let's say, from when The God Delusion was published, where do we stand now? Do you feel like the movement is still growing? Is it waning? What do you feel?
I don't know whether the movement's growing or waning. What I know is the questions are still there. They're still being talked about. I think I and every Christian apologist are hugely grateful to Richard Dawkins, Christopher Hitchens and others for getting this conversation underway, because it's really built in momentum. I think one of my problems is this term New Atheism, because I think when I read the books, I think the arguments are really quite traditional. I think what is new is the aggressiveness of which they're stated. I remember reading, I follow atheist blogs, I think they're very interesting, but P.Z. Myers, who's a biologist at the University of Minnesota, had this wonderful line. It wasn't all that long ago, I think it was last year. We said the old school of atheism was very, very boring. We need to spice things up. And actually, he was really making the point that these very feisty, very aggressive slogans like, for example, the God delusion or religion kills, which is one of Christopher Hitchens' little slogans, you know, actually really capture people's attention. And I'm sure it has. My concern would be really that that in simplifying things so greatly, actually I think they do atheism a disservice, I have to say. It makes it appear much more lightweight than it really is. I know, but it has really, I think, got the discussion back on, which is very important, I think, to ask, where are we 5 years on? In other words, the conversation's begun, it's still going. Where are we now? Where might it go in the future? My book really is just an attempt to say, well, let's keep this conversation going.
And you ask questions such as whether religion is delusional or evil, and question the idea that the belief that human beings are fundamentally good. It deals with reason and science, and the idea that the best hope for humanity is a new enlightenment, which is something of a feature of some of the writings of the new atheism. Let's turn to another atheist, though, and I don't know if you would describe yourself as a new atheist, Stephen, but tell us, would you? Is that a term you would take on for yourself, a new atheist?
Well, I don't really know what it means, to be honest, but if it means, as Alice suggests, kind of aggressive, you know, or perhaps embittered and fanatical, which is often what it appears to mean when people use the term, I'm going to leave it up to you to decide whether that's what I am.
Well, you're not foaming at the mouth as we speak.
Not yet, so, no. So, you never know. Maybe later.
We'll see how things develop during the course of the show. But obviously, have you sensed a renewed interest in atheism and the question of God and what place religion has in society? You know, do you feel that has been good for the whole area of debate, what these books have kind of brought about?
Well, I mean, I've always been very interested in the whole issue myself personally, and I tend to talk to people that are interested in it, so I haven't noticed very much difference really, other than I suppose that you find God cropping up in the media a bit more often than you used to. I think that's clearly the case. As for these new atheists, whatever that means exactly, I mean, they are very good at sound bites, it has to be said. And they're particularly concerned, I think, with the United States of America, where to suggest that you're an atheist is to suggest that you're sort of lower than a paedophile, frankly. I mean, that they think that you're scum, that you are evil, that you are deluded.
They?
A great many Christians in the United States of America. And I think that one of the things that these four individuals wanted to do was to just make it clear that you could be an atheist without being some sort of rabid, corrupt and evil genius, which is the way in which they're perceived to be.
Something of a reaction to, if you like, the religious majority in the United States, the feeling that they're a sort of oppressed minority is somewhere behind the approach that's being taken.
Yeah, I mean, they are one of the least trusted minorities. In fact, there was a poll that was conducted in the United States asking people who they trust most, who they trust least, who they would be most upset about their daughter marrying. An atheist was, you know, the worst possible thing.
Right. What do you make of that, Alistair? Because you seem to say in the book that you do see the cause of new atheism being terribly rhetorical, but not with a lot of substance in it. But do you acknowledge Stephen's point here that perhaps that's, you know, part of the reason that it takes on an aggressive militant tone is because it is feeling like, you know, well, we've got to fight back, you know?
Yes, I can see that could be the case. I think that, you know, when I first heard the new atheism, I thought this is in effect saying that we want equal cultural space, equal respect. And I have no problems with that at all. I think that's the way things ought to be. I think Gary Wolfe, the guy who invented this phrase, new atheism, which I think is a bad phrase, but he invented it, also tried to make the point, actually, he focuses on Richard Dawkins. He says Dawkins is not saying we want equal space for atheists simply. He's also saying those who believe in God are deluded. So there is this, I'm afraid, rhetorical projection of dislike on a religious grouping. So there is a sense in which I wish they wouldn't do this, because it really makes the temperature of the debate go up needlessly. And I think that really there are perfectly good issues to talk about without implying that because I believe in God, I'm deluded. If I believe in God, I differ from Richard Dawkins. I'm very happy to talk about why I believe and why he doesn't. But I and most people just think it's ridiculous to use this sort of flimsy rhetoric. So I think that's a concern. But certainly, I mean, I will make it absolutely clear that I see no reason to disrespect atheism. And I very much hope that atheists will respect people with religious beliefs. And that's how we all get on. So that's kind of my soundbite on this.
I mean, one of the things you bring out in the introduction to the book is that the new atheism, as far as it has a community element, is not so much a physical community. Numerically, there aren't that many people meeting together in this cause, as it were. It's rather more an online sort of phenomenon. And you worry that in some ways that has been a bad thing, in as much as you see some of the ways that people tend to interact online that can be even more aggressive and verbose than when you're in person, as it were. Are you worried by this sort of kind of the online aspect of the
I think
the
everyone who studies online communities gets very worried about the way in which they are charged by rhetoric, and very often all kinds of sloganeering and so on. And this is common to all. I mean, if you look at, for example, a socialist website or conservative websites, I mean, you get this sort of thing. So I'm not saying in any way it's peculiar to the new atheism.
You do bring up
this. Having said that, having followed these since 2004, I mean, I'm sure, I don't know if Stephen reads these things, but they're just mad. And I think, you know, I'm sure there are mad Christian websites as well. But they do really lose contact with reality a lot of points. And that's one of my concerns, perhaps partly about the new atheism, but I think more generally about this internet culture, which I think, because you can blog online anonymously, it means you're not accountable for what you say. No one knows who you are. And so you find it most astonishing. And sometimes I would have to say rather hyperbolic and occasionally even defamatory things being said. And that worries me.
One of the things you bring up, and I'll get Stephen to comment on this as well, is that there's almost a culture of no evil must be spoken of the key personas. And you particularly highlight the strange case, you call it, of Julian Baggini, who's been a previous guest on this programme, an atheist philosopher, but who was roundly condemned and criticised very strongly by the atheist community when he wrote a slightly critical article online about Dawkins and the new atheist movement. I mean, for you, is the movement... Because obviously Richard Dawkins' website proclaims itself to be an oasis of clear thinking, you know, and rationality. But your suggestion is actually, when you look at actually the kinds of emotions going on there, it's not terrible.
Well, I think one of the reasons why, I'm not quite sure whether it's Richard Dawkins or Josh Stemann then decided to kind of clamp down the website a bit, was because there were some very odd postings on that website. But I think that one of the points I'd make is looking at Julian Baggini's piece. I mean, I think when I read it, I mean, it was just saying two things that seemed to me to be very obvious and actually uncontroversial. But on certain new atheist websites, he was really rather demonized, which puzzled me. I mean, he published this article with a title chosen by the journal, not by him. And we all know that sometimes the titles publishers choose for you bear little relation to what's actually said in the article. I think it was the new atheist movement is destructive or something. Mm. And I think it was that rather than the substance. The substance was basically, look, number one, we need to acknowledge the limits of reason. Well, you know, I mean, any philosopher is going to say that. I mean, it's a perfectly reasonable point. And secondly, that there is a danger that if you concentrate on your opponents, you are in fact being defined not by what you believe, but by those you're hostile to. Mm. And I mean, those are, you know, philosophically and sociologically quite respectable points. And I was just surprised at the intensity of the reaction to that, because it just seemed to me to be very obvious points.
And then this incredible scenario last year where when the website was, as it were, the forum kind of got clamped down on a bit people were frozen out of it. There was a kind of a huge backlash against Richard Dawkins from some of his most fervent
supporters.
And
I have to say, you know, my sympathy is completely with Richard Dawkins. I think he was right to call time on some people who blogged on his website. But the thing that really disturbed me was that was the intensity of the reaction, the language used. I couldn't repeat on this program. And I just think, you know, that there's something very disturbing going on here.
What's your thoughts on this whole aspect of the movement then? The ferocity that we sometimes see, the language used, the rhetoric in the online area.
Well, I mean, that's by no means all atheists, is it? It's hardly representative.
Not.
It's a small group of people who have very strong feelings. And, you know, some of their arguments may be good and some of their arguments may be less good. I mean, this is true on both sides. On the religious side, you have people with very strong feelings who are not afraid to call it as they see it. So, for example, you'll get Cardinal Cormac Murphy O'Connor suggesting, well, quite unambiguously, that atheists are less than fully human. Now, I find that outrageous, frankly, and insulting. But he said that, and actually, I don't mind. Although I'm kind of offended, I wouldn't want him not to say it if that's what he thinks, because I'd like to have a conversation with him about that. So I don't want anyone to have to bite their lip and not say what they think. Mm. And I personally will avoid kind of inflammatory language as far as possible. Often it's
you won't
pointless.
Sell many books that way, though, Stephen.
Yeah, often,
will you?
Well, maybe not. I'll chuck a few in the next one. Often it's pointless. It just raises the heat, and there's no more light generated. But on the other hand, sometimes people point a finger at Richard Dawkins and they say about something that he said that it's terribly aggressive, and I'm reading it and thinking, but he's just saying what he thinks without any flowery prose. He's just saying what he believes to be true, and I don't consider that to be aggressive,
right,
at all. But other people do. They take offence, because there is this culture, as Dawkins himself has pointed out, that we're supposed to give religious beliefs a special kind of respect. We're not supposed to just say point blank, well, I just don't believe that, I think it's rubbish. If you say that to a religious person, they will often, very often, become terribly, terribly offended. Whereas if you say that to somebody about their political beliefs, well, then you just have a conversation about it. There's not that sense of indignation and outrage that you would dare to express such a view in such a blunt and direct way.
But what, how do you feel when, I don't know, Christopher Hitchens says, you know, some what might appear to be very offensive remarks about Mother Teresa, who most would consider to be, you know, one of the saints, you know, on this earth.
I think he retract some of the comments.
I think he did. Yes,
yeah,
but
I think he regretted some of them.
But
on the other hand, if his view is that Mother Teresa actually is not the person that she's portrayed as being, and in fact has done some really rather terrible things, and that is his view, rightly or wrongly, then I think he should be allowed to express it and explain why he holds it.
Hmm. And you're not saying people shouldn't be able to express their opinions?
No, I'm an academic. I like debates. But, I mean, really, what I would just like to be able to have the debate about God without having idiots shouting at me, you're deluded, you're a fool, you're dangerous, you're mad, you're bad, you're sad, which I get, I'm afraid. And I think what Stephen and I are actually doing is agreeing that there are a certain, how shall I put it, there's a certain fringe element to both our movements, which I think we might prefer to do without. I think that's very important to say. We must never define a movement by its fringes, by its mavericks, by its fanatics, when there's a kind of a centre which is much more stable and
but
sensible.
But having said that, the problem is that the media loves, obviously, the extremes.
They do.
And so
they do. And that's why the new atheism has this genius. And this is why P.Z. Myers is so right. You know, to get people's attention, you have to be outrageous. That's his phrase. Mm. And I think he's right. But that is a criticism of the media. I mean, unfortunately, I mean, the kind of debate I want to have, I mean, the media will just pass over. It's dull. It's academic. But for me, that's where these debates need to take place. But you know what? A punchy soundbite carries far more weight in the media.
Yeah.
And I deeply regret that, because we don't get the decent discussion that we need.
I mean, would you agree with this idea that the new atheism is essentially defined by what it's against than what it's for, Stephen? That it is, in the sense, anti-theistic, rather than simply atheistic?
Well, yeah, I take atheism to be the view that there are no gods or God. Fine. I mean, what's the problem with something, with a position being against something else? I mean,
sure. I suppose what I'm saying, though, is more the you know, that people need to be, you know, woken up from their delusion, and, you know, we need to stamp out religion. You know, Richard Dawkins says very clearly, the aim of my book is that anyone reading it will be an atheist by the time they put it down. I mean, what I'm suggesting is it the antiness of religion, you know, not just being, we don't believe in God, but we believe God is a dangerous thing to believe in. Do you follow that is kind of where the new atheism is coming from, or not?
Well, I mean, as I said right at the beginning, I don't know what new atheism means. But atheists need, I mean, some atheists believe that danger, that religion is an evil thing. Some believe it's a dangerous thing. Others don't.
Do you?
My own view, well, I wouldn't call, I certainly wouldn't call religion evil, no. Dangerous is kind of an interesting question. I mean, I've got an analogy, if you like, I could give you. Take, I don't know, nuclear power. Is that dangerous?
Depends how it's used, I guess.
Right. Now, the thing about nuclear power is that, I mean, it has its uses. We, you know, you can generate electricity with it. It can be useful. And it can be ticking away in the background quite safely without anyone really paying very much attention to it, without doing any serious harm. And indeed, it may never go wrong. But the problem about nuclear power is that when it does go wrong, it goes spectacularly wrong. There is a huge explosion, or perhaps an entire nation is rendered toxic for generations to come. So it's because it's enormously potent that it, you know, that there are these dangers attached to it. And I think the same is true of religion. You know, religion can, you know, Church of England can tick away in the background quite happily for generations without doing any very much harm. But the fact is that religion has the potential to do enormous damage. And remember that things can change quite quickly. Well, so, for example, it's only just over four of my lifetimes ago that the Holy Inquisition garrotted someone, or had the Spanish state garrot someone in Spain for failing to believe what they were told. That's not very long, is it? Things change very quickly, and so things might change again, and so we just need to keep tabs on religion, I think.
Well, it would be good. You know, this brings us into the first area that I wanted to discuss about the book, which is that the claim, you know, a central claim, if you like, of the new atheism, that religion is inexorably linked to violence in some way. Before we get to that, if you're listening and you'd like to find out more about my guests and how you can pick up a copy of Alistair's book, which is published by SBCK, do check out the Unbelievable website, premier.org.uk/unbelievable. And I'm putting links up there as well to how you can get along to the book launch. It's happening on Wednesday, the 16th of February, from 6 p.m. It's at Foyle's Bookshop on Charing Cross Road. And you can get hold of, if you like, register yourself for a place by emailing SBCK. That's publicity@spck.org.uk. There's also a phone number you can ring, 0207 592 3900. Both those details, as I say, are with the podcast of this program, premier.org.uk/unbelievable. Special exclusive, though, for Unbelievable listeners, because of course demand will be, you know, the uptake will be very quick on that particular event at Foyle's Bookshop to launch Alistair's book. We've a guaranteed 5 places for Unbelievable listeners, as well as 5 signed copies of the book. So if you would like to put yourself in the draw for that, simply email me, unbelievable@premier.org.uk. Answer this very simple question: what was the name of Alistair's best-selling book in response to The God Delusion that came out a few years ago? Okay, email me, unbelievable@premier.org.uk. I look forward to receiving those entries. We're talking about Why God Won't Go Away. It is the title of Alistair McGrath's new book, here on the programme that gets you thinking Unbelievable.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
That email address again is unbelievable@premier.org.uk. Also, the email to send any comments and questions in regard to today's show too. So, Stephen sort of introduced the topic, which forms one of the chapters of your book here, Alistair, which is the claim that essentially, when religion goes wrong, violence happens. Now, this is something that is a core aspect of the new atheist, if you like, doctrine. Some will find that an offensive way of putting it. But what is true and what is not true, as far as you're concerned, about what the new atheists are saying about religion and its links to violence?
Well, I think this in many ways is the best point new atheism makes. And we need to take this enormously seriously, because it is a big cultural issue. I want to get absolutely clear, there is no doubt that religion has caused violence in the past and does cause violence now. But that needs to be qualified very, very heavily. I mean, Christopher Hitchens, towards the beginning of his book, says, you know, religious people are plotting our destruction. which is slightly histrionic, I think. Well, I mean, certainly I'm interested in arguing with people, but that's as far as it goes, really. But the point I want to make is that, yes, there is a real risk of violence from any worldview that says we are right and you are wrong. It's simple as that. And therefore, my concern really is that this is a problem for some religious people, but it is not typical of religion. It's when religion goes wrong. I think one of my big debates with Christopher Hitchens would be, he is saying religion is bad. I say religion can turn bad, but intrinsically it's not. And therefore, you know, I quote in the book a former Archbishop of Canterbury, William Temple, who makes precisely this point. He says that religion can go very badly wrong, and I think that's absolutely right, but it can also be corrected, and when it's right, it does a lot of good. So what I want to do is really just say two things in response to this. Let me say three. First of all, it's a very good point, okay? Then the other two points I want to make is, but this is not necessarily typical. It's very easy to present fanatics, fools, and so on as being typical, and they're not. I mean, you look at Rowan Williams. What's dangerous about him? I mean, he's got his eyebrows out of control, but that's about it as far as I'm concerned. But more significantly, and I think this is something we must take very, very seriously, any movement that makes absolutist claims is prone to the very same thing. And if we look, for example, at political fanaticism, I draw in the book on Emilio Gentili's very interesting analysis, where he says that actually when political debate begins to take absolutist forms, then you're in real trouble. And so actually really what I'm saying is I'm against fanaticism of any form. And I fully concede that there is religious fanaticism. I think that's bad. But I want to broaden it out and say there's a bigger problem here. And again, I look at Alberto Toscano's recent study of fanaticism, which I think gets it exactly right, and says that fanaticism can arise when you have aggressive beliefs which, in effect, do not allow you to create space for alternatives. So it can go wrong badly, and I fully concede that, but not the way it has to be.
Okay. I'm going to get a response from you in a moment, Stephen, because we're going to go to a quick break now and see what your response is. I mean, the first thing that leaps to my mind, and perhaps you'd like to comment on it, is the fact that many atheists say, well, that's all very well, Alistair, but whoever, you know, launched a war in the name of atheism, you know, doesn't happen when you're an atheist, you know. So we'll get into that, but you're listening to an edition of Unbelievable this afternoon. Joining me here in the studio are Alistair McGrath, Professor of Theology, Ministry and Education at King's College London, and he's written many, many books. His latest, though, is Why God Won't Go Away, subtitled Engaging with the New Atheism. We're looking at that today with the help of Stephen Law, who's Provost of the Centre for Inquiry UK. Also heads up the Royal Institute of Philosophy. He's an atheist and is engaging in some of the questions we're looking at today. And we'll continue to look at this question of the link between religion and violence in just a moment's time. Here on the show that gets you thinking, Unbelievable.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Why Won't God Go Away is the subject of today's programme. I'm joined by Alistair McGrath, Professor of Theology, Ministry and Education at King's College London, a prolific author. His latest book, Why God Won't Go Away, is a critique of the new atheism. And Stephen Law, Provost of the Centre for Inquiry UK, is joining me as well in the studio. He's an atheist philosopher with his own reflections on the movement and Alistair's book. And as I said, you can get along to the official book launch on Wednesday the 16th of February. It's at Foyle's Bookshop on Charing Cross Road. That's at 6 p.m. Their places are limited, so if you want to register yourself, you can do that by emailing SPCK, the publishers of the book. That's publicity at spck.org.uk. Their phone number, 0207 592 3900. But because we know demand will be high for that, I've managed to secure 5 guaranteed places for Unbelievable listeners. If you want to enter the draw for that, do email me, unbelievable@premier.org.uk. Answer this simple question: what was the name of Alistair's best-selling book in response to Dawkins' The God Delusion? And you'll get a signed copy of Alistair's book as well thrown in. So, gentlemen, thank you very much. That last section, Alistair was making the claim there, Stephen, that the claim that religion is, you know, the cause of all evil, you know, and that sort of thing is somewhat hyperbolic. You know, yes, religion can go wrong. That's obviously true. But religion also produces an awful lot of good. This is something that perhaps the new atheism fails to recognise. Do you think there is an inexorable link between religion and violence? That seems to be the position of people like Christopher Hitchens. You know, religion poisons everything, he says. And you know, it is things like 9/11 that should wake us up to the fact that religion is a delusional and irrational belief that inevitably tends towards violence. What's your thinking on that?
Well, before I answer that question, let me just respond to Alistair's point that he made a little while ago, that violence, or the risk of violence, springs from a situation in which people are saying, we're right and you're wrong. Now, does Alistair think he's right about that? Would be my question. Because if he does, then he thinks that those who disagree with him are wrong. I disagree with Alistair. I think he's wrong, but we're not about to have any kind of punch-up, so far as I can see.
Which is a shame, it would be such a good radio programme if there was a bit of scuffling.
I don't think that... There's no problem at all with people saying, I'm right and you're wrong. I have no problem with that. I think it's terribly important that we allow people to say that. I think that what's dangerous is when we say, you're not allowed to say you're right and they're wrong. We're going to clamp down on freedom of thought and expression. We're going to police what people say and what people think. It's that kind of authoritarian control which I think is dangerous, not people saying I'm right and you're wrong.
And is that something that religion tends towards?
Well, both religious and non-religious people can be authoritarian. So what is it actually that the Holy Inquisition, Adolf Hitler, Joe Stalin, Chairman Mao, Pol Pot, all had in common? An obsession with thought control. That's the one thing that they all have. They are all authoritarians, okay? So it's authoritarianism that we should really be concerned about. I'm far less worried about whether people are religious or not than I'm worried about whether or not they're authoritarian or they have authoritarian tendencies. And it seems to me, in fact, that the atheists like myself and religious people like Alistair should probably get together in order to fight the more important battle, which is against people who are basically authoritarian in their thinking. Now, at this point, you might say, and of course, Richard Dawkins is going to be one of them, isn't he? He's a terrible author. He's not. He's hugely liberal. I mean, he's definitely on our side against the authoritarians. He says what he thinks, and he'll say, I'm right and you're wrong, but he'll probably defend to the death, as they say, your right to express your incorrect point of view. He'll want you to be allowed to say it and express it so that he can have a conversation with you and convince you that you are, in fact, mistaken. So he's not Stalinesque. That's a mistake. I think that... So now to answer the question she asked me. I think that two of the things that make religion potentially dangerous... I said it's a bit like nuclear power, can be harmless, but it has the potential to do extraordinary damage because of its potency. And one of the... Here are two things about it. The first is that I worry about. Two things I worry about are, one, its extraordinary ability to get even smart college-educated people to believe absolute rubbish. I mean, even religious people will agree that it has that power. Take the United States of America, where around about 45% of the population believe that the entire universe is 6,000 years old. Many of those people went to college, right? Why do they believe that? Because of religion, because of the power of religion to shape their thinking, to mould what's going on in their minds in a way that has absolutely nothing to do with truth and reason. That is a serious cause for concern. It's got that quite extraordinary gobsmacking potency. The other thing is that it's a kind of... it's a catalyst. If you sprinkle religion on an inclination to do good, to be charitable, say, it can magnify that, because now you're thinking, it's not just me that thinks this, it's God that thinks this, and God wants me to do it, and God will reward me for doing it or punish me if I don't. So it's a great, you know, it really gees people up to do good works. But if you sprinkle the same religious fairy dust on a negative attitude, such as some pretty negative attitudes about homosexuals or people from other countries or the role of women, you sprinkle a little bit of religious fairy dust on that, and what was already quite pernicious turns very pernicious indeed, and you may find it extremely difficult now to eradicate it. So That's kind of my answer.
It's a kind of magnifying force, either
yes,
in good ways.
Can be used in good ways. I don't want to deny that.
But it equally, when it goes wrong, it goes very wrong.
And it also has this quite extraordinary ability to get smart people to believe ridiculous things.
Alistair, this is kind of certainly a core aspect of the New Atheism. It is reacting to a certain form of Christianity, I think, and saying, you know, and perhaps, yes, the claims are overblown. All people who believe in God are faith heads, you know, airheads or whatever. But nonetheless, does it have a point that people can be persuaded to believe?
That in religious communities, you do find people like that. I don't dispute that. I know some of them. But again, I want to be very careful not to stigmatize the majority because of the minority. I think it's very important to be fair here. Stephen and I clearly have a major agreement on the whole issue of authoritarianism. And that's why I personally am so repulsed by Sam Harris's book, The End of Faith, which is the most authoritarian book I've read. He believes in torture. I mean, that's just morally repulsive. And he has this ghastly statement where he says that some people have beliefs which are so dangerous that it may be right to eliminate them, meaning the people. And I just find that ghastly. So, I mean, I personally would want very much to say that there is a real need to say, we need to think about things. And for me, that's why Christian faith makes so much sense. You think about it. So I think Stephen and I, though we might come to rather different outcomes of our thinking, actually, we'd both be very critical of those who try to impose views upon
I mean, you mentioned this the last time you were in Alistair. Mm. Sam Harris particularly bore the brunt of some of your fiercest criticism. Yes. In fact, I had an email then from a listener, a Christian listener, but who said he felt you were unjustifiedly critical of Sam Harris, described him as odious.
Yes.
He felt that your reading of his support for torture was slightly skewed. That just explain, what do you believe Sam Harris is saying about torture and its use? And that sort
he
of thing?
In a later part of the book, he does talk about torture being legally and morally appropriate. And he indicates the kind of context in which it is, in his view, appropriate. As a libertarian, I just find that repulsive. I'm not saying Sam Harris is repulsive. I'm saying his views are. And I would say that as a social liberal, I would not wish to condone torture in any shape or form. I'm not critiquing Sam Harris as a person. I'm critiquing the view. Mm. And that's just the way I am. And I think, you know, one of the points I'd like to make is that I would not want to judge the New Atheism by Sam Harris. I think you know he is not on the same level as Richard Dawkins. That's very, very clear.
And but obviously you bring him up as an example of where atheism can be authoritarian in the way it expresses its demands. Religious people shouldn't have a place in society. You know, there should be some kind of limit on
yes.
this type of thing. Do you agree that that is coming across in this whole debate, Stephen, that there are actually people who aren't simply saying what you're saying, which is let's, you know, all be sensible and have a good debate about it, and atheism isn't about being authoritarian, but there are some people who would like atheism to be a bit more authoritarian in saying these are the limits of what you can say.
I haven't come across it, to be honest, and I'm afraid I haven't read that particular book by Sam Harris, so I'm not in a position to comment, but I'd be kind of surprised actually, if that were Sam Harris's view, and disappointed. But I simply don't know whether it is or it isn't. But I just don't know of any atheist who isn't basically a liberal who is very much in favour of freedom of thought and expression.
And is this the natural tendency, do you think, of not having a belief in God? Is this kind of, you know, live and let live, you know, liberal attitude? Mm. Is that a kind of something that happens when you become an atheist?
Not necessarily. I mean, you know, as I pointed out, you know, Stalin was an atheist and he was a horrible authoritarian. I think what's...
But you seem to be mentioning it as in support.
As a matter of fact. I mean, as a matter of... I'm just pointing out this as a fact that I'm just not aware. Perhaps they exist in this country. I mean, atheists who actually think that religious points of view should not be heard in the public sphere. You often hear people, religious people, claiming that there are all sorts of atheists out there that want to stuff socks in their mouth whenever they say anything religious in public. But the fact is, these people do not exist. What atheists generally want is a level playing field. They just don't want religious people to have a loudhailer or a megaphone supplied to them by the state, which effectively privileges their voice and their views, which gives them a special status. That's all we want as a rule, and that's certainly the view of, say, the British Humanist Association. Just a level playing field, that's all we want. We do not want to gag Christians or prevent them from expressing their religious points of view here, there, or anywhere else.
Alistair, I mean, in general, the atheists you meet presumably are pretty liberal, open-minded people.
Most atheists I meet are, because I'm an academic, are very intelligent people and very socially liberal people. I do meet a more dogmatic kind. I mean, for example, this is 2011. We're celebrating the anniversary of the King James Bible of 1611. And the BBC put on a programme of readings from this, which was celebrating both the cultural and religious significance of this. And was the National Secular Society who had problems with that? I just thought it was an obvious thing to do. But, I mean, I, what I'm saying is, you know, we must try and draw a distinction between ordinary atheists who are, the ones I know are very generous. You know, I don't believe in God, but I'm so glad you do. But there are more aggressive authoritarian ones. And actually, you know, if I am focusing on any group of people of being critical to, really, it's not these ordinary atheists at all. I go on very well with them. It is this more aggressive group who actually I think are doing atheism a disservice. I think that's the thing, because it creates the impression in everyone's mind that atheism is very militant, which isn't true. And I think that there's a need for a rethink here within the atheist movement about who are their public spokespersons, because I think that they are not perhaps being well served by those who have appointed themselves as its spokesman.
Let's just take a quick break to tell people that if you want to listen back to this programme and you want to find out more about my guests today, Stephen Law and Alistair McGrath, and Alistair's new book, Why God Won't Go Away, published by SBCK, do check out the Unbelievable website where this programme is available for download. premier.org.uk/unbelievable is the place to go. If you want to email me today with your thoughts on the New Atheist Movement, then do email unbelievable@premier.org.uk. I look forward to receiving those. Don't forget, you can also interact with the programme via our Facebook and Twitter accounts. If you go to the website that I just mentioned, you can click through to the Facebook page, like the show, and start talking with us there. You can also follow my tweets on Twitter as well. It's a technological age we live in, isn't it? premier.org.uk/unbelievable if you want to do any of those things.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Another of your chapters, Alistair, deals with particularly the rationality of belief. Here's something that I've been coming up against a lot recently in my conversations with atheists. And this is a young atheist who I've been chatting to recently. Obviously, has been, you know, looking on forums and things. And he's been saying to me, I don't have to prove my disbelief in God. The thing you need to do is prove God to me. My atheism is the default position, you know, and making this distinction between believing there is no God and I don't believe in a God. Okay, I have a lack of belief in a God. He says, I don't need to prove that there is no God. That would be an impossible thing to do. What you need to do is prove that there is a God. But you claim, Alistair, in the book that atheism is a form of a faith position, that there is a sense in which if you are an atheist per se rather than an agnostic, you do have a particular belief. What would your response be to this young atheist?
Well, my response would be that there are different kinds of atheism. I mean, that is very, very clear. I mean, I have many friends who are, let's say, functionally atheists, and they don't believe in there's a God. But it's not something they've really thought about very much. It's just the way they are. And it's not that they've considered arguments either this way or the other. It's just that is not an issue for them. So I've no doubt that they don't believe in God. But it's not because they've really thought the thing through. And actually, they may not believe in God now, but they might in the future. So that is that. What I'm really talking about is committed atheists who say, you know, in effect, in our view, here are the reasons why there is no God. And we think that's right, and I fully respect that. I take a different perspective. And as far as I'm concerned, you know, these atheists who have thought this through will say, I don't believe there's a God, I believe there is a God. But we do need to be absolutely clear here that there are limits to what we can prove. And your, I think, young correspondent here is perhaps using the word prove in a rather loose sense. I mean, rigorous proof actually really is something that's limited to logic and mathematics. When it comes to anything engaging the empirical world, actually we're in a different ballpark. And I think that I'm slightly concerned about the uncritical use of the word proof here, because in many ways it's much more to do with what seems to be the best explanation of things. Mm.
And I suppose that's, you know, most of the time what we are doing, we're saying we've all got the same set of facts. What's the best explanation for them? And that's not going to be a kind of knockdown mathematical logical proof necessarily, but it's going to be an argument to the best explanation, let's say. What do you make of this issue? When you define yourself as an atheist, mm-hmm. Stephen, do you say that means I lack a belief in a god or gods? Or does it mean I have the positive belief that there is no God? And does it make a difference?
Well, yeah, the word is used in both those ways, actually. Although nowadays it tends more often to be used to mean, you know, you actively disbelieve, which I do, actually. I don't believe that there's a God. In fact, I believe there is no God, certainly no God of the sort that Alistair happens to believe in.
Is there any imperative on you to back up that belief, as it were? Do you have to produce an argument? Because this is the point many atheists say is, the burden of proof isn't on me, it's on you. My position is the natural default position. The theist has to give me the proofs for God, because the lack of belief in God is something you're born with. No one has a belief in God when they're born. These are just arguments I've heard, and just to be interested in where you start.
Right, well, I mean, there are so many gods that one might believe in, you know, Zeus and Thor, enormous pantheons of gods which have come and gone, and you might believe in a creator that is neither good nor evil, or a creator that's evil, or a team of creators, or a good one and an evil one who has seen some kind of cosmic bad. There's no end of god hypotheses we might entertain. And, of course, religious people dismiss 99.9% of them, but retain one. They say, oh, except for this one. This one's true. This one is the real God. And that suggests then that actually for all of us, the default position is actually to reject belief in these things, because religious people do it too. And because there's no good reason to believe in any of these other things, they don't believe it. I suppose they do believe that it's not an unreasonable thing for them to hold the belief that they do. My view is that... So that was a terrible explanation.
It's
I just
right,
gave.
No,
but moving on.
Made sense to me.
Moving on to the point I really wanted to make, which is this, that I think that you can give good empirical grounds that would establish beyond reasonable doubt that there is no all-powerful, all-knowing, supremely benevolent creator God. I mean, I think you can establish that pretty conclusively. Notice I don't say prove. Establish it pretty conclusively on the basis of, you know, observing the world around us. I think that that's ruled out pretty decisively. That's my view.
Okay. Perhaps we don't have time to get into the ins and outs of how you would do that, and I'd love to do on another program.
Well, I mean, I can do it in 30 seconds.
All right, it in 30 seconds, and then let's have 30-second response from Alistair.
Consider another good hypothesis, that the world is the creation of an all-powerful, all-knowing, supremely evil being. Who believes that? Nobody. Why don't they believe it? Well, I mean, there's one very obvious reason why no one believes it, because, you know, that kind of hypothesis would have observable consequences. If this really were an all-powerful, supremely evil being, you would expect the world to contain far more pain and suffering and horrendous stuff. I know it's got some in it, but it hasn't got nearly enough. There's way too much good stuff, love and laughter and rainbows, for this to be the creation of such a God. And so even if we don't know what kind of God ultimately is out there, if any, we can cross that one off our list on the basis of empirical observation. But if we can do that in the case of the all-powerful, all-knowing, all-evil God, then I don't see why, in principle, we couldn't do the same for the all-powerful, all-knowing, all-good one.
Okay, Alistair.
In 30 seconds, very briefly, I think what I'd want to say is that a Christian reading of this, which goes beyond pure theism, would say this world, kind of way, is no longer the world it once was. And therefore, I agree entirely that we look at an empirically mixed world. There is good and there's evil. But you can't map directly from that to God because of this idea that the world has fallen away. And this very strong Christian belief that one day it will be restored to what God intends. So, you know, Stephen's argument would be a very good argument, I think, against theism. In that straight God sense, but the Christian way of looking at things is rather more complex, and so that is a very brief response to that.
Does that satisfy you?
No,
I'm sure it doesn't.
The full story is then bolted on in order to try and deal with the horrendous problem that theists otherwise face, that there's just overwhelming evidence against what they believe. There's no good reason to suppose that this attempt to explain the problem away is true. I could come up with a similar kind of story to explain why an evil God would allow quite a lot of good stuff in the universe. I mean, there are actually some very good stories you can tell about that. You could say God allows us to do good deeds, for example. Why? Well, he gave us free will, and as a result of free will, we choose to do good sometimes, which is bad from evil God's point of view. But luckily, we very often choose to do evil, and the evil we choose to do of our own free will is then moral evil, which is the worst kind of evil. So this is a worst world with free will in it and some good in it as a result. So I can use the same old explanations to defend my belief in an evil God, but of course you'll just laugh, won't you?
Well, I of course, you know, the problem of evil and suffering, you know, there have been many theodicies put forward by Christian philosophers down the years. I suppose the point is that there are also positive arguments in other fields that would, you know, be brought to bear, and Alistair has done that with in his works, you know, a fine-tuned universe and things
but no,
like that.
They're all just as good arguments for an evil God. They're completely neutral on the moral properties of God. And yet, who believes in evil God? Nobody.
Well, I think we need a separate program on this. But the point I'd want to make is that we just don't have any other universe to compare this with, so we can calibrate these notions of good and evil. And my concern is that a seemingly objective discussion is actually tempered by subjective notions of what is good and what is evil. And one of the points I make in the book is that actually there is a very interesting debate that needs to be had about the way in which our thinking about such moral values and so on are shaped by sociological, Darwinian, other forces that may lie beyond our control. So one of my concerns, actually, is that picking up a point Richard Christopher Hitchens makes, which he says we need to transcend our limitations, actually, I think it's rather difficult to do that. But again, I think we need a separate program to talk about this.
Wouldn't we?
I just say exactly the same about the evil God. I mean, you know, it's very difficult to calibrate or, you know, what good and evil are and how we measure them. So maybe there is an evil God and this really
is the question, why is the natural assumption the good God rather than
Evasive nonsense, frankly, that Christians have spent 2,000 years developing, and they're very, very good at it, and it's very, very sophisticated, but ultimately it's just a big smokescreen to disguise what should really be staring everyone in the face.
Alistair, I mean, got a couple of minutes before we have to come to the end of this section, and we'll have a chance to wind up there. But in a sense, what Stephen seems to be asking is why a good God and not a bad God, both in his view, are equally likely. Both are equally unlikely. Do you have any objective proof to say it is a good God, that if there is a God, it would be a good God rather than a bad God?
Well, again, you use the word proof, and I think we need to be very clear that that is actually not a very legitimate word in this context. And in many ways, the question is, from a purely rationalist perspective, you know, in other words, using purely human reason, can we sort this out? But of course, from a Christian perspective, actually, you know, we're dealing with something rather different, which is this very strong belief that God makes himself known. And this does actually kind of way begin to engage at a different level. I mean, Stephen, I think, would probably say that God, by definition, cannot make himself known. But, I mean, the Christian vision of God is that of a God who does self-disclose. And that gives us this framework for looking at this world, which, in my view, does help us make sense of the existence of evil, which I fully concede as being an issue for all of us, and tries to give us a way not simply of making sense of why evil is there, but actually coping with the reality of evil in everyday life. And it seems to me that, there are two things here. One is that it does give us a framework for making sense of evil, but much more importantly, it gives us a way of beginning to engage with it and try and say, look, we can cope with this, and we can try and do something about this. So it's not simply a question of making sense of things, it's trying to engage with it and take it further. And certainly Stephen is right. I mean, there are various notions of God down the ages, and by a process of, if you like, Darwinian attrition, some of these have simply been left dead on the seashore of life. But the key point is that this vision of God remains enormously influential because people find it resonates with their experience of the world and their own way of
So it's not simply a case of, well, I just believe in one less God than you do. It's the question of, well, what is that God and what does it represent and why would someone find it such an appealing prospect?
Well, that's the position I'm taking, really. I mean, I think that, you know, one can make the argument, look, we've moved from, you know, 10 zillion gods down to this number, and then so just one less makes no difference. I think it does, actually. It's equivalent to saying, look, I believe there is meaning in life or there's no meaning in life. It is a rather...
It does make some rather bigger
it's a quantum
changes
leap
than just yes. deleting Zeus off the
that's,
list.
That's my
We're going to come up with the final section of the programme in just a minute's time. You're listening to Unbelievable, asking the question, why won't God go away? My guests, Alistair McGrath and Stephen Law. And we'll see you on the other side of a short advert break. Welcome back to Unbelievable with me, Justin Brierley. The programme every Saturday between 2 and 2.30 and 4, I forgot my timings there, that brings you Christian and non-Christian debate, as well as online at premier.org.uk/unbelievable. Next week on the programme, Alistair McGrath already mentioned, it is of course the 400th anniversary of the King James Version of the Bible this year. Well, we're looking at the King James Version next week and looking at a certain debate within the Christian Church. There is a certain section of the Christian Church that believes the King James Version is the only authoritative, reliable version for use in Christian worship. We're going to be hearing from Kyle Paisley, the son no less of Ian Paisley, on why he believes that. He's a minister in the Presbyterian Free Church. Against that notion will be Christian apologist James White, who's written a book on the King James Version only controversy. Very interesting discussion to be had next week at the same time. Do tune in for that if you can, and online at premier.org.uk/unbelievable. Back though to this afternoon's discussion on why God won't go away.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
And as I said, Alistair McGrath has been with me, along with Stephen Law. Alistair is a Christian. He's a professor of theology, ministry and education at King's College London. He's been one of the principal respondents to the new atheism. And Stephen is an atheist, a provost of the Centre for Inquiry UK. You can find them at cfiuk.org. But I'll give out addresses for both my guests with the Unbelievable podcast at premier.org.uk/unbelievable. Just a final reminder that if you want to get along to the book launch of Alistair's new book, Why God Won't Go Away, it's happening on Wednesday the 16th of February at Foyle's Bookshop at Charing Cross Road in London from 6 p.m. Places are limited, so if you want to book in for that, you can email SBCK, the publisher. That's publicity@spck.org.uk, or phone their office on 0207 592 3900. But we have guaranteed 5 places for Unbelievable listeners. So if you want to enter the draw for that, do email me, unbelievable@premier.org.uk, and answer this simple question. What was the name of Alistair's best-selling book in response to Dawkins' The God Delusion? And you'll get a signed copy of the book as well, if you're one of the 5 lucky people to be drawn out of the hat. Gentlemen, thank you for being with me on the programme today. Just as we come to conclude today, you wanted to respond, I think, first of all, to something Alistair said in the last section of the programme, Steve.
Well, I mean, to recap, you asked Alistair, why then is it more reasonable to believe in a good God rather than an evil God? If correct me if I'm wrong, Alistair, I might get this wrong, but your suggestion was that, well, first of all, God makes himself known to us, and also, in so doing, he offers us, you know, reassurances and succor, and allows us, gives us tools that we can use to cope with suffering and so on. Well, I mean, so far as God making himself known is concerned, I mean, I suppose you might say, well, people, you know, people have religious experiences, don't they? But they have so many different kinds of religious experience. You know, some people see Zeus, other people see Jesus, other people see, you know, an innumerable number of different kind of gods with different characteristics. George Bush used to experience God in his gut, apparently, and God told him to go to war with Iraq. There are so many different kinds of God experiences, with God supposedly communicating himself to people. It's clear that because these experiences contradict each other so dramatically in many cases, that the vast majority cannot be reliable, and that throws them all basically into doubt. It's also true, incidentally, that there are quite a lot of people, I'm told, who believe that they are experiencing some terrible malevolence behind the universe. Some terrible, perhaps an evil god, you see. And those people generally put on medication, whereas the people that experience the good god generally put on a dog collar, don't they?
Well, there you go. There's your soundbite, if you wanted one, Alistair.
But in terms of offering succour, I mean, then we're changing the subject. I mean, it is true, perhaps, that a good god is a rather more reassuring thing to believe in than an evil god. I grant you that. But that's hardly a reason for supposing it's true.
Well, you talked about a self-disclosing god, Alistair, and obviously that's within the Christian framework, is in the person of Jesus Christ. Jesus Christ, if you like, puts on flesh, that God puts on flesh and reveals his character to us, and that is obviously a loving God. But I suppose Stephen's point is just as subjective as any other person's belief about God, isn't it?
He's making an interesting point there. I mean, what he's doing is pointing to the wide range of religious beliefs about God. But as someone who loves studying the history of philosophy, I mean, I am astonished at the wide varieties of the outcome of the application of reason. And I note, you know, the very significant differences between philosophers who use reason in different ways and arrive at very different outcomes. And in fact, I'm very interested in the way in which so many philosophical debates are still wide open. I think there's a genuine debate here about how we use things like reason or revelation to arrive at firm conclusions. But the multiplicity of outcomes, I think, don't think invalidates the fact there are certain resources we use in arriving at those conclusions.
Before we finish, guys, I think, you know, let's go back to the title of the book, Why God Won't Go Away. I mean, many have predicted the demise of God down the years, yet belief in God seems to be just as fervent today as it ever was. I mean, perhaps in the West, you know, especially Europe, we might say there's been a decline in church going. But that's not actually reflective of what's happening around the world. There are more Christian believers than there ever have been in the history of the world today, Stephen. What's your feeling? I mean, do you feel, as obviously the new certain brands of the atheists in the new atheism feel, that if reason and rationality is going to win the day, then religion must inevitably decline because it is not a rational point of view? Do you feel the same way? Do you feel that if we are going to move forward into a world of more reason, that religion will inevitably die away in that process?
Well, because I think that religion is largely unreasonable. If that were the direction in which we were moving, that we were becoming more rational and reasonable, then obviously I would predict a decline in religious belief. But I don't predict a decline in religious belief.
Are we therefore becoming more irrational as a world?
I don't know. I'm not a sociologist, I'm a philosopher. I don't have the statistics available that would allow me to confidently make an assertion about which way things are headed. But I do tend to agree with psychologists like Justin Barrett at the University of Oxford, who says that actually even if you could eradicate religious belief entirely, it would be back within a generation because it's kind of hardwired into us. I think that there may be some truth to that. I mean, Barrett has suggested that we have an HADD, as he calls it, a hyperactive agency detecting device, which natural selection has equipped us with, which means that we're kind of oversensitive to agency, to other beings who operate with beliefs and desires. And so if we hear a rustle in the bushes behind us, our first reaction is not to think, oh, that's just the wind. We spin around thinking there's someone there. It comes on straight away, sure. The agency detecting device. And very often there isn't someone there, but we feel like there's someone there, and so we will tend to over-detect agency. We will see agency where there is none, and where when we don't see it, we'll suppose it's invisible, and where we needed to explain stuff, we'll suppose it has supernatural powers. And that's why throughout the world you'll find people believing in invisible people, dead ancestors, and so on. And I think that, to some extent... by no means wholly, but begins to explain why there is this widespread, seemingly ineradicable tendency to view the world as being populated by or having behind it invisible beings of some sort.
I mean, what Stephen's saying there is not dissimilar to what Daniel Dennett has said in Breaking the Spell, giving us a psychological, evolutionary sort of explanation for religion and why it is still so prevalent. But for you, Alistair, what is the reason God won't go away?
Well, a Christian would say that we are hardwired to believe in God. I mean, that is just the way we've been made. And that's, Christians have been saying that since the New Testament. And indeed, if you go back to the Judaic tradition, it's there from about 1200 BC. This is the way we are as human beings. And I'm very grateful to Daniel Dennett for speculating a little bit about what the evolutionary base of this might be. But that, in many ways, is simply offering an account of what we already know to be true. So I would say there is a natural predisposition, which is based on the fact that we are made in certain ways to believe in God. But the point I'd want to make is really this, that we've been talking a lot in this very interesting discussion about the rational adequacy of faith. And I think that's a very important point. But there is something else, and that is the existential question. Because there are many things that, might be plausibly argued to be true, but actually make no difference to life and don't give you any sense of meaning. And I've always been very struck by the kind of arguments put forward in books dealing with the whole question of what we need to keep us alive and sane. In other words, what are the big questions of meaning, the existential issues? And that's why I look at a whole series of works which emphasize the need for frameworks of meaning, because they give existential significance. Now, of course, this doesn't prove it's right, but one of the points I'd want to make is that people are looking for something that gives them direction, gives them a sense of identity and purpose, and that is an extremely important need. And so one of the reasons I think that Charles Taylor's recent book, A Secular Age, is so interesting is that he kind of highlights how there is this yearning for the transcendent within humanity, and that leads them in certain directions. And so really what I'm saying is, I don't think this God is going to go away, because we have a homing instinct for God, and social pressures may try to distance us from those. The educational system may say, oh, this is just primitive superstition, but actually deep down, there is something saying there is a home for you to go to, and it's there. And that, I think, is a very important consideration.
As the writer of Ecclesiastes puts it, eternity has been set in our hearts, something like that. But very interesting discussion, gentlemen. Thank you both for coming in and giving your time to this. And thank you, especially Stephen, for coming in to, be the other side of the debate here. If you want to find out more about Stephen, he's the provost of the Centre for Inquiry UK. You can find them at cfiuk.org. Alistair is profiled on many websites, but I'll put up a link with the podcast of this to where you can find out more about him and his work, and of course get a copy of Why God Won't Go Away. That's all to be found at premier.org.uk/unbelievable. We look forward to perhaps seeing you both again in the future, gentlemen. Thank you for the very good-natured discussion here. No foaming.
No punch-ups.
No. I look forward to seeing you again at some point in the future. If you're listening and you've been getting in touch with me in the last few weeks in regards to various programmes we've been having, then you'll probably hear your name mentioned in a moment's time. We're going to be reading out some of your response to the last few weeks of programming and play out some of your voicemail messages as well.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Well, time to look at some of your feedback over the last few weeks of programming, and a lot of response to last week's program, which was a really fascinating interaction between Mark Rock, who is a Christian subversive storyteller. He was interacting with Paul Thompson, an atheist and a member of the Premier community. Sinbad is the name he goes by. And they were asking, why do we value human life? Can it be accounted for on atheism? And this really ties into the whole question of morality, you know, the moral argument for God. If we do believe in ultimate moral values, how can that be on an atheist framework? Can only a theistic framework explain it? All that sort of thing. Lots of you getting in touch because I think it engaged people because of the storytelling nature of that one. Mark had a number of stories he drew upon to suggest that atheism as a worldview is bankrupt in some way. So both Christians and atheists getting in touch with me on the back of it. Before we go to some of those responses, just a quick shout out to Brad Green. I think you're out in the States, Brad, but you've just mentioned my podcast, the Unbelievable podcast, on your own blog, because you were over in Cambridge for a few months last year and discovered it that way. So thanks very much. That's bradleyggreen.com if anyone wants to look up Brad's website, bradleyggreen.com. Now, turning to responses to Mark and Paul's interaction last week, here's Peter S. Williams, who is, of course, a Christian philosopher, listened to the show, enjoyed it thoroughly. He says, the atheist guest, Paul, kept changing the subject, but Mark didn't let him get away with the evasion and got him to admit that on his worldview, people have no intrinsic objective value and that this was possibly a problem for atheism. Someone else who enjoyed this and has been commenting about it on the Facebook page of Unbelievable is a friend of the show, Peter Byram, who says, loved the episode. Mark is one serious dude and really pushes both my apologetics and theatrical buttons. I guess engaging the imagination is an important part of apologetics, and that's something that Mark seems to be doing for people. You've also been getting in touch by phone about this, so let's hear a couple of your messages.
My name is Frey. I've just been listening to this, and when you pointed out what Mary Stopes actually believed, I think enough people don't discuss these beliefs. This recent case in the paper where this nurse had given a leaflet to somebody about abortion and how it could really destroy their psychological and physiological thinking. I'm open on birth control and various points on that, but I do believe, you know, a child is conceived at conception. Thank you, bye.
Hi, Justin, this is Jane. A comment was made about the non-Christian fans of the Christian about, well, your whole belief system is based on father sacrificing his son, and I must confess this is something that I really struggle with because of past issues, etc. So I just wanted to say I'd be really interested to hear that discussion, because obviously you didn't have time to do it today, but it'd be really helpful to hear it, and maybe other people would find it helpful as well, because as I say, I'm sure I'm not the only one that has a problem with it. Okay, thanks, bye.
Thank you for both of those, and to the second caller we heard there, yes, I'm sure we will fit in an edition of the show looking at specifically, if you like, the doctrine of the atonement and what that means. Is it an immoral idea that God would put the sin of the world and the punishment for the world upon his son? And different ways of looking at that, I'm sure, would be interesting, perhaps around Easter time. But lots of atheists getting in touch as well, though. Here's Simon Tyler. I'm only going to read out some portions of your email, Simon. Fascinating as it is, it's too long to read the whole thing. Two quick responses. He says, although Paul did admirably well, I found myself getting annoyed at him for not shooting down Mark when Mark kept claiming that Paul didn't directly address his questions. Here's two quick responses you would give, Simon, to the whole area of values and whether we need a God to establish them. You say an atheist doesn't believe in the Christian God, thus to them that Mark's claim that his values come from us being made in the image of God is also a human invention, and the values are made up from nothing. The origins of his values in that sense are no better than what he thinks of the origins of atheist values. Well, I suppose that's the whole point of the conversation, though, isn't it, Simon, that you know, if this is obviously dependent upon an atheist acknowledging that there is ultimate value in human beings that transcends everything, nature included, then there is a question to answer. Obviously there isn't if you don't believe that. You say atheism itself is nothing more than a statement of disbelief in theistic explanations. Atheist values and morals come from other ideas such as humanism, and you give an idea of how that might be borne out in the golden rule. The value of a human life follows from that. I don't want to be treated badly or killed, and I assume other people feel just the same way. And there is an evolutionary just so story for how and why humans obtained the ability to empathize. yes, that may be the way in which morality developed. Therefore, is it just an is, or is it an ought, as it were, that there is some intrinsic point about human value? If children are being sacrificed, even though the Golden Rule tells us we wouldn't like it if we had been sacrificed as a child, that is something that should be imposed upon them to stop doing that. But that surely can only happen if there is some intrinsic value to human beings. But anyway, that's sparked a lot of interest from various people. Sorry I couldn't read out more of your email there, Simon. Do email again, though. Xander is an atheist as well. He says, I find myself agreeing partly with your Christian guest, Mark, and disagreeing quite a bit with your atheist guest, Paul. On the one hand, it does seem clear to me that our sense of human value and morals were bequeathed to us by a combination of evolution and society. Nonetheless, it is a mistake to try to justify human value or morals based on either evolution or God. While Paul is right that Deuteronomy shows that we can't count on God to tell us that the Nazis' actions were evil or why, I think he makes a great mistake in relativizing human worth. Evolution gives almost all of us empathy for those we perceive as being like us. The exception, of course, are the psychopaths, which make up a tiny minority of the population. But evolution also gives us enmity for those we perceive to be in the out-group. The history of humanity, especially in the last few thousand years, has been to organize ourselves into larger units and apply empathy to an expanding circle. But evolution cannot do much over time's period as short as a few thousand years. In order for civilization to thrive, it had to make it possible for larger and larger groups of people to get along with each other and help each other to survive. Religion, including Christianity, has played an important part in this. However, it has also been on the wrong side of history, for example, in the case of slavery and so on. But you say, anyway, even if evolution and religion got us where we are, justification should depend on principles such as minimizing harm to others and respecting their autonomy. It shouldn't depend on evolution or just because God said so. The problem with saying because God said so is that God appears to be saying different things to different people at different times in history, and that explanation ends up being as relativistic as saying that all human value depends on worthiness to other people. Again, I mean, similar points there to Simon. What I would say is the point that I always feel those kinds of emails miss is that it's not actually about whether we can justify from the Bible whether God, the Bible, and what God appears to do in the Bible is moral or not. It's a question of that very principle you've outlined there of minimizing harm to others and respecting their autonomy, how you justify that as being something that everybody should adhere to, if it isn't actually inherent or somehow objective. Anyway, thank you very much. And let's go to some other Christians who wanted to respond to this. Nick wants to respond to some of the specifics of Paul's arguments. Paul was talking about Deuteronomy 13 as being an example of, you know, why we can't rely on the Bible for morality. God appears to commit acts of genocide through the people of Israel. But you say, Nick, actually, it's all about upholding the social order. If someone comes and leads the people astray, then they're actually guilty of treason. To call people away from Yahweh would be to call people to follow another and go against the dictates of Yahweh, which provided the guidelines for society. This would uphold the social order. Later, however, Paul said in the program that what he values is that which will uphold society. So I guess you're pointing out some kind of a contradiction in Paul's thinking there. As for genocide, you say, genocide wasn't done in the Old Testament. People were not exterminated based on race, but on practice. And the race as a whole happened to practice what was condemned. And when Israel did the same thing, they got the exact same treatment. And you go on to talk about the whole issue of morality. The best part came when Paul said that absolute morality is rigid and relative morality can better itself. Well, better itself by what way? Is he admitting his morality is deficient in some way now? By what standard? Oh, wait, can't have a standard. How ought his morality to improve? Again, there can't be an ought. It's saying my moral standard is better by the standard of the moral standard. If he had just thought about it, he would have seen how silly it is, says Nick. Here's Dave Parker, who says, thanks for another great show. Something occurred to me listening to the atheist Paul. He admits that according to atheist views, the value of the individual is relative, but counters by saying that behaving morally is good because it benefits society at large. Well, my question for him takes it a step further. What makes society at large a thing of value which must be protected? He talked about how tribes of cannibals that eat their neighbours are being immoral because that behaviour damages society. But really, Why would a consistent atheist care at all about society? It seems to me that atheists need to either admit that it's all meaningless and embrace their descent into madness like their father Nietzsche, or preferably admit that their moral code is actually objective and has been placed in their soul by God. Whew! If you want to join in, unbelievable@premier.org.uk. And there's also a discussion on it going on online at the Premier community. You can find that, of course, via the Unbelievable webpage, premier.org.uk/unbelievable. Lots of people as well responding on the Facebook page, which you can get to from that link as well, to a video I posted up there that person I mentioned earlier, Peter Byram, has made of a little element of Christopher Hitchens and William Lane Craig's debate last year. And the video is entitled Christopher Hitchens Struggles to Define His Atheism. Quite a few people engaged in a conversation there. You might be interested in that one as well. Oh, and I wanted to get time for some more general emails, but I'm running out of time. Just a quick shout out to Nicole. You said, can I put the website of Unbelievable up on my new blog? And you say you're looking to open a door for intelligent, thoughtful conversations among non-traditional types interested in Christianity, etc. And, well, I would say you don't need to ask my permission, Nicole, out in New York. Go ahead. I'd be delighted to be associated with any podcast of such a type. So thanks very much for that. Get some more of your feedback at the same time next week. In the meantime, thank you for joining me on the show today. Hope you've enjoyed it. Don't forget to go to the website for more details about how to get along to the book launch for Alistair's new book, Why God Won't Go Away. And don't forget to email me if you'd like to be entered in the draw for the definite places for that and signed copies of his book. That's all for the moment. Let me tell you what's coming up on the show next week.
You're unbelievable.
Well, continuing a series of programmes that we'll be playing out this year in commemoration of the 400th anniversary of the King James Version of the Bible, we will be looking at the King James Version itself. And two Christians join me on the show next week. One believes that the King James Version, the authorized version, is the only and best version that Christians should use in their worship and devotion. The other says no, that there are better translations with better texts based on more reliable manuscripts. They are Kyle Paisley. He is a son of Ian Paisley, the Northern Ireland DUP leader. And he's a minister himself. He's always used the authorised version, says that is the best version for use. James White is a Christian from America, heads up Alpha and Omega Ministries. He's written against the King James Version only movement, and we'll be hearing their discussion this time next week. Hope you can join me for that. In the meantime, thank you for listening today, and have a good week.